tonight on Arena. Ardal O'Hanlon on his new documentary about Harry Clarke's Geneva Window. And we celebrate the career of the multi-talented Warren Beatty. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The Geneva Window is the last masterpiece of the Irish stained glass artist Harry Clarke. 8 extraordinary panels take as their inspiration seems from the work of 15 writers, including Joyce, Synge, Yeats and Lady Gregory. Fans of Clarke will recognise the jewel-like colour palette he favoured, the amazing figures he drew in glass and even their fantastical surroundings. But it's fair to say that the Irish government of the 1920s, who commissioned the Geneva Window in the first place, were less than impressed. Indeed, the work is still and currently on display in the Wolfsonian Museum in Florida. Perhaps it is the presence of nudity, drunkenness and sensuality that means that the stained glass window is still going to scandalise the nation. Certainly, back in the day, it was considered hardly the thing for an artwork that was to represent the country as an official gift to the League of Nations. Ardal O'Hanlon tells the remarkable story of the Geneva Window in a new documentary called The Geneva Window Through a Glass Darkly. It's directed by Jerry Hoban, and I'm delighted to be joined by Ardal on the line for this evening's Arena. First of all, Ardal, just before we get into the extraordinary story here, how do you describe this window, which you were lucky enough to actually get to stand in front of in the Wolfsonian Museum in Miami?
Yeah, that's right. I first stumbled upon it about 10 years ago. I happened to be in Miami on a little break, and there was a thunderstorm, and I stepped in out of the rain into the Wolfsonian Museum. There was an exhibition of Soviet poster art there, which I was quite interested in. It is a museum of propaganda and the arts after all. And there was the Geneva Window in front of me. So it was a story that I was only dimly aware of. It's possibly not Harry's finest achievement, but anyone who's lucky enough to go to the Hugh Lane Gallery in Dublin will see the Eve of St. Agnes. And that's probably the nearest kind of touchstone to it. You know, it's got all the intricate detail that you would associate with Harry Clarke. It's got the amazing colours. It's got the amazing costumes, you know, in terms of the dresses and the footwear, particularly, that his characters invariably wear. You know, it's got that dark imagination. It's got all those elements of fantasy. So, it's representative of sort of both sides of Harry Clarke, the sacred and the profane.
And actually, as we're speaking now, we're going to tweet an image of the Geneva Window so that people can get a sense of how exactly it looks. It's 8 different glass panels, 15 writers represented across those panels. Extraordinary set of writers, first of all, that Clarke chose to represent here.
Yeah. Now, apparently he got help from Yeats and his own friend Lennox Robinson, who was one of the founders of the Abbey Theatre. And, you know, it was very representative. It was a great cross-section of what was available at the time, I think. I mean, I think we were in the middle of the Irish literary revival. So, I mean, you know, you have all the writers that you mentioned there at the top, Yeats, Synge, Shaw, who was a Nobel Prize winner. Yeats was a Nobel Prize winner. I mean, we were top of our game in terms of literature, you know, and recognized for it internationally at the time. You also had Lady Gregory. You had like lesser known writers like George Fitzmaurice and Seamus O'Sullivan. You had O'Casey there. So it was obviously a great time, a fertile time for Irish literature.
For
and
sure.
He captured all that.
Yeah.
But it's also very inclusive, you know, apart from the fact that there weren't very many women writers. And, you know, there is a list in the archives, like they did consider people like Edith Somerville and people like that. But for whatever reason, they went with the ones they went with.
Yeah, Edith Somerville, who has described the stained glass windows in the Honan Church in Cork as gorgeous and sinful. You touched on it, Ardal, there. this two sides to Harry Clark, both the sacred and the profane. He came from a background. His father kind of, made stained glass windows, made stuff for churches around the country. So he had that aspect to him, but there was very much a secular side to Harry Clark's work as well.
Yeah, I mean, he was equally known for his illustrations of books by, say, the likes of Hans Christian Andersen and more pertinently, I suppose, Edgar Allan Poe, where he gave full rein to his very vivid and very macabre imagination. You know, so you know, those illustrations will feature all sorts of demons and all sorts of hellish splendor, as I think Edith Somerville also referred to. You know, lots of phalluses and vulvas. And, you know, so it was a remarkable contradiction for someone best known in Ireland for his church windows. And he was, you know, and he celebrated rightly for that. And it's like, it's hard to believe that, you know, the priests and bishops who commissioned these stained glass windows for the churches, like, weren't aware of this other side to Harry. And it's also hard to believe that the government of the day, while they were trying to select a work of art to submit to Geneva, you know, when we joined the League of Nations, that they chose Harry, that they weren't aware of his dark imagination, that, like, he wasn't the reliable figure that they imagined him to be.
Yeah, you speak to several people along the way about various aspects of Harry Clark's work, in particular Anne Wilson, who is a lecturer in visual culture. And she's talking about at this point in time windows that are in the Honan Church, the Honan Chapel in Cork, and she's very interesting on what exactly it is. When Harry Clark thinks of a saint, he maybe doesn't think in religious terms.
His characters, his saints, they're not these sweet, nice, traditional saints. They have a darkness to them. They have a slightly menacing look, quite a few of them. And I just get the impression that he really enjoyed, and you can see it in his other work, there's a sort of a Beardsley-esque fascination with this dark side
of damnation.
Life. Yeah, and damnation. Depravity, yeah. Which is really interesting for somebody who is embarking on a career full of church commissions and government commissions. He came from his father's studio, Joshua Clark, and Joshua, you know, had him well trained in what you need to do to please the priests. But obviously he had this dark side to him that escaped every so often when it was allowed to, you know, and his creativity just ran riot.
There we go. That's Dr. Anne Wilson in a clip there from the documentary that we're speaking about this evening, a documentary about the Geneva window of Harry Clark, The Geneva Window Through a Glass Darkly. It's presented by Ardal O'Hanlon, who's speaking with me on Arena this evening. And she really gives us a sense there, Anne Wilson, Ardal, of the kind of the darkness that was there in his church work. But when it comes to this Geneva window, you go through in the documentary, you go through all of the writers. I'm thinking in particularly maybe of something like Deirdre, which was a George Russell play, obviously talking about Deirdre and Naois. But it's a very erotic version of the Deirdre and Naois story that we get in this. And later on, there's another of the panels features Liam O'Flaherty, none too flattering, a picture of him kind of bousying away and this very attractive young woman naked in front of him as well. These weren't necessarily representations of the stories that he was inspired by. They were kind of his versions of those stories, Harry Clark's versions.
Yeah. There were jumping off points, I think, for Harry's imagination. You know, and he started off innocently enough. You'll note in the first panel and the second panel. I mean, the first panel is The Wayfarer by Padraig Pearce, so no one's going to object to that. The second panel is, I think it's St. Joan by George Bernard Shaw, you know. Like, again, no one's going to object to that. So, like, it's like he was hoping the government and the senior civil servants wouldn't look beyond the first couple of panels. Because as you go down the window, you come across the Liam O'Flaherty piece. Now, by this time, by the time he actually presented the window, Liam O'Flaherty was very much on the banned list. The Censorship of Publications Act had come into being, and Liam O'Flaherty was a big thorn in the side of the government, a critic of the government. I mean, I think he described them as gombeen men, you know. He was one of many writers, I suppose, who was very disappointed with what happened after the War of Independence.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, but also like that, you know, so it's not just the fact that O'Flaherty's represented at all. I think that was one of their big objections. it's the fact that the panel that he chose, you know, features this very lecherous man, Mr. Gilhooly, who's ogling a naked girl dancing in front of him. He's got a cigar in one hand, he's got a glass of champagne in the other, and his large belly is protruding through his unbuttoned shirt, you know. So, like, this is not how the government wanted Ireland to be represented in Geneva.
And had they fears for the nation itself that perhaps we would be scandalised by such a set of images being put out there to portray us? Were they worried for our moral life as well?
I think there were. I mean, the more enlightened members of the cabinet, and there were plenty of enlightened people, not just in government, but also in the civil service, and people who really did admire the work, you know, on the whole. But I think they felt that, you know, this was for Geneva. This would never be seen in the country. I think they were hoping to kind of smuggle it out of the country really quickly before anyone saw it. But of course, the church got wind of it. And by the end of the 20s, the church were in a very powerful position. And the government, in fairness to them, like, they had already had some big run-ins with the church. I think there was one about a librarian in Mayo. Yeah. I think Mayo County Council had appointed a Protestant librarian. And so they'd already fought a number of battles on that front, and they didn't need another one. You know, I think this was one of their big dilemmas, you know. But the church had come out strongly against it. They also suggested, not just in terms of the lecherous content. And then you've got the O'Casey panel, which features sort of drunkenness, you know, and there's a bottle of Guinness and a bottle of whiskey represented in that. But it's the fact that most of the writers were, or at least half of the writers were Protestant. So the Catholic Church, in some of the Catholic intellectual circles, they described it as a Protestant conspiracy.
Gosh, it's amazing. And, you know, W.T. Cosgrave, who was the Taoiseach, or what the equivalent of the Taoiseach, what was it called, the President of the Executive Council?
President of the Executive, yeah.
Yeah, the equivalent of the modern-day Taoiseach, effectively. He actually was quite enlightened initially, and even in his first response to the window, in a letter to Harry Clarke, he kind of says, you know, maybe for your own sake, Harry, have a little think about adjusting things ever so slightly for your own career and your own reputation. But very quickly, within a week, when the other not government members but civil servants and the like came to view the window, the tone of Cosgrave's attitude changed enormously.
Yeah. I mean, that's right. I mean, Cosgrave, by all accounts, was a devout Catholic, but not a Philistine. He knew Clark personally, and Clark's wife, Margaret Crilly, who was also an artist. He had launched an exhibition for both of them only a year or two previously. So he was an admirer of Clark. And I think you can see in the correspondence, and the correspondence is absolutely fascinating. It's in our archives. And it's wonderful. And you know, he corresponded directly with Clark himself. Like, it wasn't through civil servants. You know, and it was very courteous and cordial, but he was gently trying to let Clark know that he had to change some of the panels, you know, particularly the O'Flaherty one, if there was any chance of this commission going ahead. But Clark, being the artist that he was, being an extraordinary visionary artist and quite a stubborn man, you know, and who is only accountable to himself and his artistic vision, you know, whereas Cosgrave, you know, in fairness to him, like, he's got a lot of things to consider and he's got a lot of interest groups on his back. So, you know, his responsibilities to everyone, whereas Clark's is really only to himself and his artistic vision.
The sadness, there's a very personal aspect to the story as you tell it in the documentary as well, Ardal, which is Harry Clarke himself had TB in both lungs and in fact was in Davos at the time recuperating when all of this problem was breaking up around the actual window itself and whether it would ever make its way to Geneva. That aspect of the story and the fact that his wife was kind of forced into buying the window back, it's incredibly sad and moving.
Oh, it's heartbreaking. I mean, this story, like, I think it's a wonderful story, you know, not just about a work of art, but about the foundation of the state and, you know, the contest for the type of Ireland, you know, that we wanted and that we possibly could have had, you know. But it's also just a very moving story of a man, you know, who's on death's door when he's delivering it. And there's a kind of a, you know, will it happen, won't it happen kind of aspect to it. Will he be paid? Eventually, you know, he is paid for it. But the state decide not to send it to Geneva. They get cold feet at the last minute. It lies in storage for a couple of years. And then Margaret is, you know, because she wants to know what's going to happen to it. And she's eventually kind of forced into buying it back for the same amount that they were paid for it. So, and then it ends up, you know, unseen for decades,
yeah.
Really.
Yeah, it was in the Hugh Lane for a period up until the 1980s, I think, and then it was sold off to the Wolfsonian, which is a real shame that we don't get a chance to see it at home here.
Yeah, I mean I suppose it tells a story in its own right. You know, no one ever knew what to do with it. I suppose it was considered toxic. It was considered just too provocative and salacious in so many ways. And it ended up, I think it's kind of like a suitable home for it in some ways. You know, it is a dedicated museum of propaganda and the arts. You know, it kind of has Nazi era stuff. It's got Soviet era stuff, you know, celebrating, you know, those particular nations at those particular times in history, you know, in the way that the governments of the day wanted to be represented. You know, so this kind of fits in with that kind of whole scheme in a way. I think Harry Clark might be tickled by the fact that it ended up there in some strange way. You know, and I think like it just, no one knew what to do with it. The Hugh Lane Gallery didn't really know what to do with it for many, many years. You know, it was lent to them on occasions by the family and it ended up in storage there as well. You know, So it's just all very, very odd. It's a shame that, you know, it was put up for auction finally, I think, by the family who were sort of, it seemed to be fed up about the whole thing in the 80s. And I think it was sold at Sotheby's in London for, not a vast sum. Yeah. 150,000 was the figure that was mentioned, and now it's priceless.
Yeah, certainly is that. And there is a great irony in what eventually did go to Geneva in terms of how the early Irish state was represented in Geneva and the League of Nations. And I know you're a fan. You say this in the documentary. You're a fan of Sean Keating's, but what is up on the wall is a mural, effectively. And it's classic Keating, you know, the perfect country that we live in. Maybe you would describe that work which you went to view as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I suppose my problem with it is it's not a problem really. Mm. Like it's a very fine work of art by any standards. It's a mural in this building, the International Labour Organization building in Geneva, and but it could come from anywhere. You know, it's celebrating industry. It's a commission. I mean, he was working to commission. He was doing it for the money. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Mm. So it features, you know, it features the bloodstock industry. It features shipbuilding. It features, you know, some men in lab coats are building a computer. You know, there's very little sense that like this is Ireland. This could be anywhere. This was what this is what Soviet Union was doing. This is what Mao's China was doing. Yeah. This is what like America in the 50s was doing. You know, you've got all these mostly men featured in the painting, you know, all, you know, just representing Ireland as a thrusting, forward-looking, industrializing nation, you know. So it's just a very different way of looking at the country than Harry Clark had looked at. And the irony was that Keating and Clark were actually great, great friends for many, many years.
No, certainly none of those very fine shoes that were in the St. Agnes window, I think, that you spotted the shoes on, wasn't it? That you read the Eva St. Agnes window. You really wanted those blue high-heeled shoes.
Yeah. No. He's a big loss to fashion design. That's all I can say about Harry. I mean, his influences were just, they were legion, you know. He was influenced by everything and anything. He's an extraordinary man, an extraordinary artist.
I wonder to what extent, Ardal, if I can phrase this one properly, obviously, you know, your comedian chops are still there. Your acting chops are very much on display in various places at the moment. You seemed to be very personally invested in this particular story. That's what came across. Now, was that very fine acting? But you mentioned that moment when you came into the Smithsonian back in whatever, when you had that break in Miami 10 years ago. Did it kind of stick with you? Was it a project that did come more from the heart than maybe we might expect in a documentary?
Well, I mean, I don't make a terrible amount of documentaries, but when I do, I like to be really, really invested in them. I work very closely with a collaborator, producer, director friend of mine called Jerry Hoban,
yeah,
who who's, you know, we're on the same wavelength on a lot of things, you know, that help to understand and explain Ireland, you know. So we've made shows like in the past. We made the recent one about the last priests of Ireland. We made one a few years ago about funeral culture and death notices, our fascination with all of that. It was called Guess Who's Dead. And we did one during COVID about our propensity to use bad language and where that might come from, you know, our love of swearing. So, you know, we have a little bit of a track record in these areas. Jerry came to me with the idea. My first exposure to Harry Clarke was as a kid in church. The church in Carrickmacross, where I come from, has luckily, you know, has some very fine examples of Harry Clarke windows. And, you know, as a child, your mind would wander at Mass and your attention would be drawn towards these very strange and beautiful windows, you know, like these very sensual figures that weren't necessarily very holy, you know. you know, so I've always had an interest in Harry Clarke, I suppose. And then I did stumble upon the Geneva window. And then Jerry came to me with the idea. He was always fascinated by the story. I was only like vaguely aware of the actual story of the Geneva window. But Jerry knew it inside out and he really wanted to make this show for many, many years. And so he came to me with it and I jumped at it and we both dived in, you know. I really fall in love with the man is probably too strong a term, but I, you know, the more I read about him, and there's a magnificent literature out there. There's wonderful essays by Roisin Kennedy, who's a contributor to our program. There's an amazing, lavish, monumental, comprehensive book by Nicola Gordon Bowe for anyone interested in Harry Clarke. I'm sure they've already got it, but if they haven't, they should go to, you know, get their hands on it straight away. You know, so the more you learn about him, the more fascinating he is. By all accounts, a charming man, almost a dandy in Dublin of the day. You know, we have this idea that Dublin in the early part of the 20th century was a very grey and conservative place, but there was this counterculture, you know, and I think Harry just represented that in a way that, you know, I found really, really fascinating.
Well, I'm glad to hear that the fascination with blue high-heeled shoes goes right back to Carrickmacross.
Oh, God, yeah.
That's South County South County Monaghan for you. You'd have none of that up in North County Monaghan now.
No, you could have been arrested for wearing a cravat in South County Monaghan.
Finally, I suppose there is a kind of an irony that the Geneva window through a glass darkly will actually be broadcast on Oireachtas TV, given that government story.
It's extraordinary. Well, Oireachtas TV provides some of the best drama now on Irish television, as we all know. And they do commission stuff. They made that fantastic Noel Brown documentary there last year. Excuse me. So it's going to be shown on Oireachtas TV, I think, on the 22nd of March and again on the 24th of March.
Okay, precisely right, Ardal. That's the Geneva window through a glass darkly on Oireachtas TV, 6 p.m. on Friday, March 22nd. Repeat the following Sunday, March the 24th at 9 p.m. Thanks so much for chatting to us about it today, Ardal.
Absolute pleasure, Sean. Thanks a million.
Over the past 10 years, artist Marianne Keating has investigated colonial histories linking Ireland and Jamaica. The Model in Sligo will present a new film by Keating. It's called On Cunis, The Silence, a 3-channel film installation that traces multiple trajectories of migration from Ireland to both Jamaica and Britain from before the Great Famine right up to the present day. Olyocht Ufosach, A Terrible Beauty, will feature two other recent film works by Keating, including A Beautiful Dream, which explores the way in which Ireland's fight for self-determination mirrored similar movements in other colonies of the British Empire and gained support from Marcus Garvey, who we were speaking about on the programme last night, in fact. Delighted to be joined by Marianne Keating from our Sligo studio this evening. That connection between the Irish diaspora and their presence in the Caribbean, how did that interest come about for you? I believe there was a residency there a while back, Marianne, that kind of kicked the whole thing off in your imagination.
Hi, thanks for having me. So in 2013, I was awarded a residency in Jamaica. And I, at the time, I knew very little about Jamaica and I arrived quite soon after being awarded it. So about 2 weeks later, I landed in Jamaica. And when I was there, I started to notice words in Jamaican patois, which is a national language, which were of Irish descent. So like Gansey, which we use for jumper, is used in patois to mean t-shirt. And I started to question how words from a language, our language, that at times had been almost like banned during or British colonization, that they existed in Jamaica. So I started to question how these words had transferred. And very quickly, I started to notice loads of different threads, Irish threads in Jamaica. Like, there's loads of different place names, like Clonmel, the hometown that I'm from. There's a Clonmel in Jamaica. There's an Irish town. There's a Knockpatrick. There's Ulster Springs. There's all these different places. So it was very clear to me that the Irish had arrived in Jamaica. And I set about finding how they got there. And yeah, that became my research.
Yeah, and I suppose Marcus Garvey is kind of linked into this. In that, is there a Liberty Hall in Jamaica, or have I just made that up?
No. Yeah, there is, and it's been named after his relationship as well with Ireland. So there's all these anti-colonial ties that kind of tie the two nations together. But also, when we look at what I examined most clearly, I suppose, was Irish migration via indentured labour, which happened after abolition when the Jamaican plantocracy needed a new labour force to work on the plantations in Jamaica, and the now free enslaved refused to work for the old masters. They needed to recruit a new labour force, and Ireland, which at the time would have been seen by the British to be overpopulated, was a fertile ground for recruitment. So the Irish then were brought over not only to work on the plantations, but also to increase the white population on the island.
And I think what we're talking about there is a type of slave trade, effectively indentured slaves. Now, what sort of age group were we talking about here? How were these people chosen, and how were they then, you know, how was it decided that group of people are going to be brought to Jamaica to work on the plantations?
Well, there's a big difference between indentured labour and enslavement, and the Irish were never enslaved within Jamaica. Indentured labour is a signed contract where you willingly go ahead and you sign a contract from 3 to 10 years. In Jamaica, it was 3 to 7 years, starting with children. So starting with child labour as well. So children from the age of 7 could sign into indenture. But with that, you, whether they agreed to or not, but families would travel together. But with that indenture contract, you would get your passage to Jamaica and you would get housing and provisions once you arrived. But that's not to say that the contracts were perfect in any way. There was a massive case in Limerick in 1840 where the SS Robert Kerr was a ship who was going to Jamaica with 700 Irish on board. And in all the Limerick leaders, all the newspapers at the time, there was ads for Irish to go to Jamaica to work on the plantations. But they also said that there was Catholic churches in Jamaica, which there was very, very few of, if there was any. So people started to question if that part of the ad is false, how much of the rest of it is false. So there ended up being a controversy about where were the Irish going, what were the conditions they were going under. And in the end, 121 people left on that boat. And the migration happened, continued in different ways, some of it legally through systems that were put in place and some of it by other landlords who were just recruiting privately themselves. Yeah. But once the Irish worked on the plantations, if they ran away and escaped, they were free and they were also white. So they could assimilate into the white class structure in Jamaica very, very easily. So there is there's a lot of hardships that happened to the indentured labourers. Often they had to fell the trees on the land to build their housing before they got to that point. But we also have to be, I think, quite careful not to mix the two things together, if that makes sense.
No, and I take your point about indentured labour being an absolutely different situation. But it was economic necessity, it sounds, exactly, to a large extent, that sent these Irish people to Jamaica in the first place. Was it a very confined period in history then? Because you are looking at, in the film certainly, and on Cunis, The Silence, and I love the fact that it has both the languages there. You are looking at all sorts of migrations from Ireland to both Britain and to Jamaica.
Yeah. So I think it's very much kind of economic is what, I don't think that has ever really changed within our history. It's always been the one thread that's kind of brought us through. Even during the famine, it was also about survival. And I think that's the same for anyone who migrates from any country. It's everyone trying to find, to exist and survive and to find maybe a better life. And in the context of Jamaica, through there was a lot of poor white labourers that went to Jamaica, not necessarily always through indenture, but we also have these two political figures, Norman Manley and Alexander Bustamante, who became the driving force of Jamaican politics from the 1938 onwards during the Frome's riots, where they came forward as kind of the leaders of the people, but not necessarily because they were the most vocal. There was a black nationalist movement at the time that was fighting for workers' rights. But because of their proximity to whiteness, these two men, who two generations before their grandfathers arrived as poor Irish labourers, were able to start these two-party political system that's still in existence today in Jamaica, and going on to become the first Prime Minister of Jamaica. So it's kind of, there's quite a large Irish diaspora community in Jamaica, but it's not necessarily, it's not something that you'll find linked together. Mm. It's all over, but it's not necessarily recorded as other communities are in different places.
Yeah, so this is part of what you're doing on Cunis, The Silence, by taking various layers. I suppose it's easier to get footage from more recent emigration, particularly to Britain, and in terms of the building sites and the labour that the people that worked in those particular people built the roads in Britain as well. But you find all sorts of historical aspects, historical images, found footage here as well. Where did you go searching for this? Because it seems to span right through from the 1840s up until fairly recent times.
Yeah, I've been hanging out in quite a lot of archives. So I kind of do this kind of triangular mapping. I suppose, like, in Ireland, we lost 95% of all our records during the Civil War with the bombardment of the forecourts, right? So we've lost a lot of our information. So I would use the archives in Jamaica and England to kind of fill in the gaps that we're missing here. But also within the Jamaican archives, the audiovisual archives in Jamaica have denied me access 4 different times to footage from the 70s and 80s of political speeches. For what reasons? I'm always given a different reason, but that then forces me to look to online sources where people have taped things from the TV that they see to be of importance. And I start to reconstruct these narratives and these gaps through all the different information I have, from talking to people on the street, from, you know, over years of filming in Jamaica. I'll be filming somewhere and a fisherman will come up and talk to me and he's like, "What are you doing?" And I'll explain to him, and then he'll tell me a story and that will relate to some political situation at the time. So it's a lot of chatting and a lot of negotiation. I'm not a historian, I'm an artist. Mm. So to me, it's not about the recorded history that exists, like who decided, like in the National Archives in England, that information has been sterilized and sterilized and sterilized. And who has been written by? It's not been written by necessarily the Jamaican people or the Irish people. It's written from the British colonial government and their perspective of Ireland and Jamaica. So I kind of track these histories and talk to people who maybe were there during the 1938 Thrones riots and have a personal experience of those situations and are kind of the living embodiment of that history.
Yeah, so there's one family that we see a woman, I think it is, and her brother subsequently talking about, I think it's their maternal grandmother that was one of these people who came from Ireland at the time. Was that something that you filmed yourself? Did you find those people, or was that an older documentary that you then came across?
So it's a bit of everything. So when I was telling you about the court case in Limerick, that gave me a time period in to look to the archives in Jamaica. So in Jamaica, nothing is digitized. So you're literally going page by page. Mm. So then I found this kind of 30-page document where the British colonial government were asking, what is happening to the Irish people in Jamaica? There's been this big kind of public hearing in Limerick, and they demanded that the planters write this report. And through that report, I found the shipping list and the names of the Irish people, their ages, the name of their kids, everything else, and the plantations they went to work on in Jamaica. So one of the places was where Will V. Bormer still lives to this day. So I went up to Freeman's Hall with Wayne, who's a friend of mine, and he's a taxi man because I don't drive, and sometimes my sound man. And we just go into a local road food, you know, just a bar on the side of the road, talk to the locals, ask, does anyone know of anyone of Irish descent? And gradually, once they kind of work out if they decide to trust you or not, then they'll maybe introduce you to an elder in the community. And then that's how I managed to find Will V. So I interviewed Will V for hours and hours and hours. But to me, it was kind of like, how can I tell the story also of her relatives who have since passed away? So it starts with me talking in her garden, surrounded by all the trees that her generations of her family would have grown over the last 200 years. And then we cut back to this kind of already a recorded documentary that was looking at a different aspect. But within that, I could pull threads out.
The other thing, you touched on it there, this idea of, you know, how sanitised the stories were in terms of the British colonial master at the time. This exhibition and these films have been seen, I think, in London, and now they will be touring. It's not just that they're at the Model in Sega, they will be touring around as well. Do you expect a different type of response or from an Irish audience? I mean, I must say it's kind of surprise. It's a story that surprised me. I wasn't that aware of those connections.
Yeah, it's kind of like it's a kind of an unknown history. It's something that's kind of got buried along the way. I'm very interested to show it in Ireland because I've lived in London since 2011. Mm. So I kind of got pushed out by the recession and ended up there. But also, I kind of became, I suppose, more Irish living in London because you're living in a different, you're seeing things through different eyes as well. And often throughout the years, people like would think that I'm part of the United Kingdom and I'm like, no, I'm from the Republic. It's a different place. Or a friend of mine who went to Cambridge didn't even know that the Irish had their own language. So you're constantly fighting with this thing where this history of our people has been kind of removed from the history books in schools in England. So within that context, I talk about one way, but then it's also bringing it home in is another, because there's people that know these histories in relation to the Irish context far better than I know. So it's kind of interesting to see. But I think within the Jamaican Caribbean context, maybe some of that information isn't fully known. So
there are two other. So on Cunis, The Silence is, I think, kind of the major part of the exhibition, Marianne. Then we have two other films that are part of this as well. One called A Beautiful Dream. And I was interested that another one is called Landlessness, which, of course, in terms of Ireland, once you say the word land, it's a very potent, it's a very potent term. Does it hold that same kind of status in Jamaica?
Yeah, I think, but it's also within the context of Jamaica, it's still very complex, right? Because we still have the old British colonial system. If you want to purchase a piece of land, you still have to know the 19th century law to be able to deal with that. So it limits a lot of people from access to purchasing land. But it's also since enslavement, a lot of people have never been given land or been able to purchase land. So they're technically for generations been living what would be, I suppose, termed illegally on land. And now they're being cleared for these mass developments of hotels. So I think land and land ownership and place is, there's two different contexts. Within Ireland, we have, you know, we have been here for, you know, since whenever, but within the context of Jamaica, it's basically, it's people that have been pulled, ripped up from their lives in Africa, from all these different places to work on what was an a slave colony. And it's kind of that attachment to land is different, I suppose, in different ways, because it's also, it wasn't their land of birth initially. So I think, there's kind of, there's different things. The film Landlessness deals with the Irish migration to Jamaica in the 1840s and deals with the reasons why the Irish left. And then it also talks about the plantations of where they settled in Jamaica.
Finally, then, the overall title of the three films that make up the exhibition, Áilleacht Ó Fáisceadh. Wonderful translation of A Terrible Beauty. Yeah. Obviously a nod to Yeats, I'm guessing, there. And given your location, that's hardly surprising.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it kind of ties in kind of all those kind of the context of colonialism and kind of these two countries which were colonized and kind of the people completely oppressed by the British colonial system. But it also talks about like this kind of beauty or people fighting for themselves and fighting for their freedom and self-determination and liberty within it, and kind of the power of kind of relying, self-reliance, and not relying on others to save them, but saving themselves as they in such. But we're also dealing with those legacies of, you know, how free is independence, and you know, are we ever freely, really free? Because if you're still tied to the colonial system through the party political systems and things like that. So A Terrible Beauty, it just seemed fitting for where we are and what the exhibition is
about. Unfree independence is a great term as well, which you're exploring in the midst of all of that. Thanks for speaking to us this evening, Marianne.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
And that's Marianne Keating. And Áilleacht Ó Fáisceadh, A Terrible Beauty, runs at the Model in Sligo from the 16th of March through till the 19th of May, and includes a larger presentation of Marianne's work as well. Subsequent tour venues include the Galway Arts Centre, Brewer Red, Limerick City Gallery of Art and Wexford Arts Centre. You'll get full details on themodel.ie and mariannekeating.com. At the Academy Awards ceremony 45 years ago, the film Heaven Can Wait received 9 Oscar nominations. 4 of those were for Warren Beatty in the categories of actor, writer, director and best picture. Beatty then went on to replicate this achievement 3 years later for his film Reds, and in the process made Oscar history. The success catapulted him into becoming one of Hollywood's most powerful and influential figures for decades. And tonight, to discuss Beatty's wide-ranging career and just ahead of his 87th birthday this month, that is Beatty's 87th birthday this month, I'm joined now by Stephen Benedict. We would love to hear of Element Pictures getting 4 more Oscars in a few years' time. That would make us all very happy. But Beatty, now, it was four Oscar nominations and then repeated that a couple of years on. Was there anybody who came close to this, they call it the four-cornered Hollywood filmmaker?
Well, you'd have to go back about 100 years to the silent era with Charlie Chaplin. He wrote, produced, directed and starred in his own pictures. But that's because he was one of the 4 founding members of his own studio, United Artists. But in the studio era, meaning the post-1930s, Orson Welles was the first person to be nominated in 4 different categories for his first film, Citizen Kane. But very, very quickly, Welles then fell foul of the studios because his second film, The Magnificent Ambersons, was a complete flop. I mean, it was butchered by the studio before it was released. But the thing was, Warren Beatty, when he arrived in Hollywood, ingratiated himself into the good graces of studio heads, agents, and he studied Orson Welles' failure. And
that's
sure
interesting
because
Welles, of course, would not have been given, he wouldn't have been the most modest man in the world and had an uncanny knack of rubbing people up the wrong way.
Absolutely, absolutely. And now Beatty is not the most modest person either, but he has an uncanny knack of making sure he doesn't rub people up the wrong way.
I have to say, at some point, he's so vain he probably thinks this idea is about him. to paraphrase the song, which possibly is or isn't about him.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the beginning then. Born in Virginia, not as Warren Beatty, but as Henny Warren Beatty.
Yeah. Hey,
do you think that's significant?
Yeah, I do. I mean, the thing is, Beatty, he's often referred to as an enigma, okay? And he's very, very hard to pin down. He gives very, very few public interviews. When he does, he gives a lengthy interview, but he doesn't give anything away. And I know it sounds corny, but just let's think about his name for a second. He was originally called Beatty, right? Yeah. To rhyme with Sweetie. But it was he who added the second T to his name. It was Beatty's only one T. And all of a sudden, he insisted that would be pronounced Beatty, as in weighty, gravitas, power. That's what he was all on about. And then if you also consider his
first... That's very Wellesian, very Orson Welles, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yes. But then if you consider his first name, Warren, a maze, a labyrinth, and he invites people in and they're all convinced that you are the only person in his world. And he plays you like a puppet. And he leaves you in the maze. A very, very famous event happened. One of the most powerful critics in the United States in the 1960s, 70s, 80s was a lady called Pauline Kael. And she was at this stage where she could actually make or break a film. This is when critics held great power. And he wooed her and he invited her out to Hollywood and he got her a job, got her a production development deal with Paramount Pictures. And she spent an entire year just reading scripts, but the scripts that she developed, the scripts that she chose, never went beyond reading stage. And that was his lesson to her. You do not mess with Warren Beatty. And she wasted a year and she went back to Hollywood, but she went back to New York completely chastened. So, you know, once you get into Warren's maze, you never get out.
Yeah. And now, I mean, we have to, he started out as an actor and obviously that production mind and that Wellesian mind was there behind all of this. But how did the acting start and how much charisma was there involved in Beatty himself?
Yeah, well, the charisma was actually a great thing at the start. But for people who recognise good actors when they saw them, it became a stumbling block because he went to New York to study acting at Stella Adler's School of Acting. And Stella Adler was one of the doyen of the acting coaches. And when she saw him, she was completely unenamoured. Here was this pretty boy who appears to be coasting on his good looks. And one day he strolled into class deathly late. And Adler cut him dead with a withering welcome. Ah, here's Mr. Broadway. And he very quickly left. He didn't finish. He didn't graduate from school. Went to Hollywood. And that sort of hung around him like a wreath around his neck. Because very quickly, he was categorized as just the pretty boy. George Hamilton, the actor, was a contemporary of his. And if you think about what happened to George Hamilton's career, nothing. And Warren Beatty looked at that and said, I'm not going to go the same way. And then he went into producing.
And he produced Bonnie and Clyde,
yes.
In which he acted in 1967. How significant was that?
Enormously. We've got to understand that, you know, when Beatty made the shift to start producing his own pictures, the studio system, the classical studio system, was in decline. The CEOs were either in retirement or they were dying, or the studios were being bought over by different conglomerates. So into that vacuum, there was a second vacuum which occurred when the audiences started to decline. Audiences were suddenly not going to the cinema in the great numbers that they were. So the studios were panicking. They didn't know what to do. They started taking risks. They said, let's take a punt on this movie called Bonnie and Clyde. But they really didn't want to make it. So what Warren Beatty did was, he deferred his salary as producer and actor in return for 40% of the gross. Not profits, 40% of the gross. Now, the movie surprised everybody because in 1967-68, it went on to earn $70 million at the box office. Adjust that to inflation today, that's over $500 million. 40% of half a billion.
Half a billion is the guts of a quarter of a not too much shy of a quarter of a billion, which kind of would sort you for a few years at any rate. Let's have a listen to him then in Bonnie and Clyde, first film he produced. Here he is acting, playing the part of Clyde Barrow, and also Faye Dunaway playing the part of Bonnie Parker.
You went to school, of course, but you didn't take to it much because you was a lot smarter than everybody else, so you just up and quit one day. Now, when you were 17, there was a guy who worked in a
cement plant.
Right, cement plant. And you liked him because he thought you were just as nice as you could be. And you almost married that guy. But then you thought, no, you didn't think you would. So then you got your job in a cafe. And now you wake up every morning, you hate it. You just hate it. You get on down there and you put on your white uniform.
Pink. It's pink.
Uh-huh. And them truck drivers come in there to eat your greasy burgers and they kid you and you kid them back. But they're stupid and dumb boys with the big old tattoos on them and you don't like it. And they ask you for dates, and sometimes you go, but you mostly don't, because all they're ever trying to do is get in your pants, whether you want them to or not. So you go on home, and you sit in your room, and you think, now, when and how am I ever going to get away from this? And now you know.
Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway there in a scene from Bonnie and Clyde. We're looking at the career of the multi-talented Warren Beatty this evening with Stephen Benedict. Just saying, as we were listening to that, Stephen, and I'm going to play a second clip shortly, he's unrecognisable. I kind of had to think, God, I can't think of Warren Beatty's voice. It's so different there.
Well, that's the thing. He's, as I said to you, he's hard to pin down. Now, I think he's a much greater producer, and I think he's a much greater director than he is as an actor. But one of the things is it's hard to imitate Warren Beatty in the way that it's easy to imitate some of his peers. It's easy to imitate Al Pacino. It's easy to imitate Jack Nicholson. It's easy to imitate Anthony Hopkins, although those actors showed much greater range. If you look at the characters that Warren Beatty has played, it's a very, very narrow spectrum, and they're all dreamers who are utterly broken by their dreams. Clyde Barrow is a gangster. He's shot to death at the end. John McCabe and McCabe and Mrs. Miller. In the Parallax view, he plays a very idealistic journalist called Joseph Frady, and he's, well, I won't give away the ending, but it's not a happy one. Shampoo, he plays this crazy-minded hairdresser called George Roundy. Jack Reed in Reds, he plays the journalist. And then most famously of all, I think, Benjamin Siegel in Bugsy. These are men who are broken by their dreams.
Let's listen to him. Remember the voice that we just heard. Now, admittedly, there's a bit of time between the two films. Yeah. But listen to the difference of the voice then. Here he is as Ziegler in Bugsy.
Las Vegas!
Las Vegas! You couldn't drag me to that sandhole rat trap with a fishnet.
We are going to build a Garden of Eden in a desert. A hotel, but not a hotel. You know what it is? It's an oasis. It's an oasis with a casino. It's legal. It's Nevada. And we're going to have palm trees and pools. We'll have rose gardens more beautiful than Versailles. And we're going to design them all ourselves.
Get away from me!
We're going to have the greatest entertainers in the world. We'll have Jolson and Cantor and Durante and Gary Cooper. We'll have Cary Victor Mature. All of them, honey. We'll have Dana Andrews, honey, and then all just hang around. Because it'll be the most beautiful, most spectacular place they've ever been invited to, and you are going to own 5.75% of the whole thing. And that's gross, not net.
There you go. Gross.
He knows about the points.
Percentages again. That's Beattie playing Benjamin Siegel trying to charm Virginia Hill, played by Annette Bening, of course, who he fell in love with it, and who we saw at the Oscars just saw in the highlights last night.
That's
not
right.
Winning the Best Actress Award, but looking very elegant as she...
Yeah, I mean, as you said, that they met on the set of Bugsy, and that's where they fell in love and they got married as a consequence. But again, going back to Warren Beatty's achievements, he starred in that picture and he produced that picture. So again, even though he will star in someone else's movie, he controls it. And it's amazing. It's amazing. You know, his control, you go in to make a movie thinking you're going to make a movie with Warren Beatty and you end up making the movie for Warren Beatty.
There you go. Is there anybody then in the contemporary filmmaking world that kind of compares? We obviously have to think of...
Well, I think George Clooney for a while was, because he was definitely writing, producing and directing his own pictures. I mean, Good Night and Good Luck, when you go back to 2006, and he received 3 Oscar nominations that night. A fourth came in his support role in the movie Syriana, for which he won the Oscar. But I think you all have to do is look to last Sunday night and look at Bradley Cooper.
Yeah.
He has amassed 12 Oscar nominations. The guy's only 49 years old. Star is Born earned him 3 Oscar nominations. Maestro the other night earned him another 3 Oscar nominations for his movie about Leonard Bernstein. And I dare say it, I think he could end up making more better movies than Warren Beatty, because for all of Warren Beatty's talents, he's only made 23 films in the last 60 years, and that is nowhere near enough in relation to his talent and his energies.
And at 87, do you think he's hung up the filmmaking boots?
I think so. You know, I'm sure he's got better things to do with his life. Living the life of happiness and comfort with Annette Bening and his children is the way to do it.
And he has to spend the rest of that $250 million.
Good luck.
I'd say maybe not too much of it left at this point. That's Stephen Benedict speaking to us about Warren Beatty, who turns 87 at the end of this month. And that is our lot for this Tuesday evening here on Arena. Paula Shields and Leah Murphy researched. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.